Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Hajime Sato, who is the chef owner of Sozai near Detroit, Michigan. He has been known for keenly pursuing sustainability, which is very challenging for sushi chef, for the last 14 years. And his efforts have been widely recognized, and this year, Hajime became one of the five nominees for the James Beard Foundation's Outstanding Chef Award. The James Beard Foundation Awards are often called the Academy Awards for Culinary Professionals, so you can tell how powerful Hajime's voice is. So today we'll discuss how Hajime came to the U.S. and became a sustainability-minded chef, how he managed to offer sustainable seafood at his Japanese restaurant, Sozai, what unknown, delicious, and sustainable seafood we should try, what we should do now for the future to keep eating, enjoying seafood, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on the iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now let's start a conversation with Hajime Sato. Hello, Hajime. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is exciting. I've been really looking forward to speaking with you. You have so much to share with us. So first of all, to get to know you, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
That's an interesting question. I grew up in the city called Utsunomiya, which is about a couple hours away from Tokyo. My mother's side from Tokyo, actually, close to Ikebukuro. It's more like a shitamachi, which is kind of like old downtown kind of thing. My father's from Hokkaido, so I grew up eating a lot of seafood from Hokkaido, and everybody can guess how old I am. When I was growing up in the Tokyo, they had a well water, like Ido, and where there's a lot of good water, I used to go to a tofu shop with the little bucket and get the tofu all the time because, tofu is about 80% water, so... So eating a really good tofu and really good, water, in the middle of Tokyo and eating good seafood from a Hokkaido. That's how I grew up.
That's why you grew up healthy like you are now.
And, another note is that when I was growing up, there's a lot of, in a farmland. So, I did, harvesting nobiru, which is kind of like a ramp, huki, even inago, which is the grasshoppers, we used to catch them and fry them, eat them. So a lot of just wild things that I used to eat, I guess.
Right. Well, I've eaten grasshoppers, and they're pretty good. And even back then, you became sustainable already. So that makes sense. What are you doing is what you're doing. Right. So when and why did you move to the U.S.?
It's kind of hard subject, but when I was in high school at the time, high school was really, strict, and you know, I got hit by teachers all the time, and just didn't want that kind of environment anymore. And fortunately, my parents had some exchange student. We were hosting an exchange student from like Australia, Canada, stuff like that. So I did know that exchange student program existed. So long story short, I took test and came to US in 1987 as an exchange student. And basically, I'm still here.
That's interesting. And people might like cringe by hearing a high school teacher hit you. But I think back then it's a kind of more strict kind of like a martial arts kind of mindset. So that's, I think it's hopefully it's changed a lot. But yeah, that used to be a part of Japanese school education, which is crazy. So, and then how did you get into cooking, and where did you study cooking Japanese food?
So I guess I was a weird kid who was hanging out with my grandma all the time, which is a lot and you know, a lot common in Japan at the time. I don't know if you did it, but to make katsuobushi in the box, that was my job. You know, like to break the kombu, or like there's a, you know, cleaning the huki. A lot of things that my grandma did, I was a prep cook, right? So to do the inari and all the stuff. So I guess I was cooking all the time with my grandma. But of course, you know, when you're high school and, you know, I went to college and I didn't do any of it. But I started working at the restaurant and as the side job. And I kind of slowly got into it. And I became an apprentice under this one sushi chef in Seattle for a while. And that's how I learned how to make sushi.
Interesting. So before we move on to the next, the katsuobushi bonito flake, if you live abroad, you just only think of the fluffy, already shaped one, but the original shape is very hard. People say it's the hardest food ever exists in on Earth. And there is a shaving kind of equipment. And my dad got a very fancy one. And it was so sharp, I was afraid to touch. But my dad was a treasure of shaving it. Yeah. It smells amazing, right? Because you shave it, it's just... you know, I like you churn the butter or something and then eat it. There was something very fresh about just shaved katsuobushi. So.
Oh, yeah. I used to eat it all the time. So my grandma's going to yell at me because, like, stop eating. I need a for dashi, right?
Right. Awesome. So we'll take a quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll dive into Hajime's sustainable philosophy and practice at Sozai Restaurant. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Hajime Sato, who is the chef owner of Sozai near Detroit, Michigan. And he has been nationally highly recognized for pursuing sustainability, which is very challenging for sushi chef. So let's talk about your restaurant, Sozai. So you opened your award-winning Mashiko in Seattle in 1994 and moved to Michigan in 2019 and opened Sozai in May 2021. And since then, you have achieved tremendous success. And as I said earlier, for example, you are one of the five nominees for the James Beard Awards Outstanding Chef Award. And James Award, James Beard Award is also called the Academy Award for Culinary Professionals. An outstanding chef means you are the best actor or actress in the whole country. Sozai means Japanese something special. So what's the meaning of sozai for our listeners?
So it's a wordplay. The listener, hopefully they know what kanji is. It's the Chinese character-ish that we use. I have two different pronunciation for one character. And sozai usually means two characters. So is like everything. And zai is usually vegetable or food. And my name, Hajime, can be read Hajime or So. To create, that's the meaning of it. And I switched the first kanji to my name so that to create food. It's a wordplay. I don't know if that makes sense.
Okay. And then soza itself in Japanese has a special meaning, right?
Right. And so if you shorten it to make a sozai, which means that the rogue ingredient. So, you know, it has a two different meaning. It's kind of fun. So that's why I like the sozai.
Okay. So the pronunciation is sozai?
It can be whatever. That's what's kind of fun about it.
Okay, you choose. All right. So that's awesome. So, why did you choose your name? Restaurant sozai, like ingredients driven.
Yeah, ingredient driven, and to create food in a way that's kind of micro and macro in a way that you have to think globally to create food. And sozai is like a micro, right? Like it's a micro. That's like a what's shun, like what's in season, what's more local, what's sustainable. So it's, again, it's got a kind of double, triple meaning of that. So, it's kind of fun name. I don't know. At the time I was thinking about it, I needed a name. So I kind of decided that. And now like, oh, that means that too. It's kind of cool. So I don't know.
Yeah, own reflection, you picked the right name.
I guess
so. Right. So, and what kinds of menus do you offer at sozai?
So we do about 90%. We do have menu, but the 90% of what we do is omakase. So it's a chef's choice, and we have different tiers from like a little more safer side to more adventurous side, from like 7 to 11 course meal. And it's all chef's choice. That gives me leverage of choosing what's fresh and what's available on that day.
Right. And then, so this is another key question. So you are known for strong focus on sustainability, which is becoming increasingly important in almost every aspect of lives now. So according to Sozai's website, in 2009, you decided to use only sustainable seafood. Why?
People ask me that all the time. And my answer is, why not? Why am I that special, right? I hope that everybody should be doing it. And I kind of resent the fact that I'm you're trailblazers and you're great and you're so unique. Like, I should not be unique. Everybody should be doing it. But unfortunately, a lot of what people eat, it's just like a given by big corporation or trend or whatever. And people don't really think about where people's where their food is coming from. And sometimes you are eating endangered species without you knowing it. And to me, we talk about computers, internet, cell phones, all the stuff that the people have. And we feel like we have so much information in front of us, but we're not really using it in a way that's like, okay, so if you study, let's say, eel, for instance, that's endangered quite a bit. All you have to do is click on the eel is sustainable or not, but people still eat it. I'm not blaming all the people because people don't have time, but at the same time, that as a chef or as a distributor or any of the export, we should be alarming those facts that's going on in this world. So to me, it's the natural progression of what any restaurant or any distributor or any of the food industry people who is involved in this thing called people eating every day. So what should we do? And some things are endangered. Maybe we should not eat it. Maybe this has got a huge environmental impact. Maybe we should not eat it. So maybe study touch more, maybe 10% more, and just change a little bit. And to me, knowing what I know and just going exactly like it used to be was not acceptable. So I hope that the people are doing a little bit more. But to me, I should not be that special. I don't know if that makes sense.
Right. It does make sense. But then, you know, in 2009, you started 100% sustainable. So was that a gradual accumulated awareness of sustainability or something happened? Like one event made you to decide shifting to 100% sustainable?
So what happens when the audience, you guys coming to the sushi bar, yeah, you don't care about the what's sustainable or not. Maybe you're on a date. You know, maybe I should not be talking to you because, you know, because it's a special night. So people don't ask me about, you know, what's sustainable, what's not. People ask me, like, what's trendy or what's cool or whatever. But when I was teaching how to make sushi, that happened. I've been doing it for a long time. And people ask me the question that's different. Like, why do you use this fish? Or do you use this fish in Japan? Is that different? How is it different? Is it sustainable? So there's a lot of different questions at the sushi making class. That's the time that I start looking at the fish a little different angle. And that's the time that I start learning about, like, holy cow, I'm actually learning that bluefin tuna is not sustainable. Then I go to my restaurant and say, hey, isn't the bluefin tuna great? And I felt really torn, and I felt like I was just hypocrite, right? Like, what am I doing? I know this is horrible, and I'm serving that in my restaurant. And that was kind of like that wake-up call for me.
Right. So, with every day you're exposed to what to make, you have to choose. So there was like a, I think you had to choose at some point. That was 2009. So, and then, of course, your restaurant is based on seafood. So how do you manage to be fully sustainable at Sozai?
So I'm going to claim this, and you say 100% sustainable, and I hope I am, but it is almost impossible, meaning I cannot check every fishery myself. I cannot trust or I cannot doubt every seafood purveyor or like distributor, right? So I try to be, but there are some mistakes too. That one time, everybody said this one product, the shrimp, I'm not going to name it, and they said it was sustainable. I was using it, and later on found out it was a horrible company and using sustainability as a kind of marketing, and I was using it. And after I noticed that, I quit using it, but it's a bottle, right? What's sustainable or not changes all the time. What's sustainable to me changes all the time. And it's an ongoing studying and the progression and getting better every day. So it's tough. And, you know, I hope that it's 100%. But even at the time I changed, probably I did like, you know, close to 90%. And even right now, you know, hopefully close to 100, but probably 99%, right? Even I'm working on so many different products that I want to get. And if I'm getting products, I still study about, hey, where is this coming from? It's been a while. Let's revisit and see if they're still sustainable or not. Or some of the stuff that's endangered is still endangered. Maybe it actually came out and maybe you can use it more now. So it is a lot of studying.
Mm. Right. So do you use the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch List to measure sustainability?
Yes, that is, well, I don't, to use one measurement to measure everything, it's a little too scary. So I look at, of course, Seafood Watch is the one that it's awesome. And I recommend so many people to do that. But I still have the friends from the University of Washington fishery people. I talk to so many different people that they know about sustainability, and they tell me a lot of things. So, but that being said, Seafood Watch is great. There is actually a sushi app that you can download, and so you can give all the sushi a hard time with that. So please do, including me.
Great. So yeah, it's really great to have more than one criteria, and I think having more criteria makes us, all of us, more aware. So I think, of course, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, I think Whole Foods uses it too. And I'm not fully aware of which one is now at this point very sustainable, or Chilean sea bass, all those things. So yeah, I was curious how you use it, but I'm just glad you have more than one, and especially like hands-on people. So, and you said that you encourage people, your guests, to try omakase menu, right? So how is it contributing very well to stay sustainable compared to regular a la carte menu?
That is such a good question, right? So I don't know if I can survive as a regular restaurant. Here's the reason why. Including you, if you go to the sushi bar, you expect certain things, right? Maybe toro, maybe hamachi, maybe unagi, right? So a lot of things you expect to have. So if you come to the regular restaurant, or then you expect to have those things. But if you come to my restaurant, we don't have any of that, right? So if it's a regular, let's say a regular menu, they look at menu as like, oh, you don't have this, you don't have this, you don't have this, right? People get disappointed. And that happened quite a bit at the time I changed to sustainable sushi bar in Seattle. So what omakase does is that the instead of I'm not having stuff that you're looking for, I can give you, you never thought about you're going to have, right? So that's a complete 180 on what you will eat. So I use that as my advantage, and I'm going to give you a lot of things that you never thought you would order. And you're going to be so satisfied to the point that you don't even notice that you didn't have any of the stuff you usually get. So, the omakase is our weapon to introduce a lot of things.
Mm, right. I think also, to be honest, the majority of us do not know what to order. So we just end up what we know, ordering what we know, like tuna or salmon or something we can recognize. And it's not their intention to not to be sustainable, but fish is so hard to remember names and how it looks. And it's so seasonal, and especially sushi place, you have no idea what it is. So I think omakase is a good educational tool and also discovery tool for new flavors, and which I do all the time because I don't know too much about the name of the fish. So I think it's a great idea, not just for sustainability.
Even when I go to Japan, I usually do omakase, right? Like when I go to, used to go to Hokkaido and I don't know what's in season. I just say, hey, what do you got? Just give me some stuff that you think it's really good. And that I learned so much about the culture and, what's in season, all the stuff that I never thought about having and I get. So, I learn so much every day of doing that, right? So, yeah, I think it's a good way to order, too.
Right. And there is a kind of misbelief that being sustainable can mean sacrificing taste, which is completely wrong. But what do you think about it?
Who said that? I'll talk to them. Somebody tweeted it. Man, assholes. There's a stigma of when you go sustainable or when you are environmentally friendly or when you are health conscious, then suddenly flavor is gone, right? I don't know. It's, I think stigma and an image of it. I don't know who starts those things. And I don't know. I said that I want to talk to them, but I just don't want to talk to them.
So as a counterpunch, you can maybe tell us some of your favorite yet to be discovered sustainable seafood. Name a few or as many as possible if you'd like.
Here's the thing. There's a lot, like start with hikarimono, right? Hikarimono is a shiny fish. So mackerel, sardines, aji, horse mackerel, all kind of stuff that the I'm really working on getting those all the time. Unfortunately, most of the those small fish becomes fish feed for like a bluefin tuna or hamachi, yellowtail, stuff like that. So, you know, we try to get those things as much as I can. I'm getting octopus that's bycatch from a cod fishery. Otherwise, they throw away about 20, 30,000 pounds of octopus probably each month throwing away. So that's coming up. I don't know. I can get more salmon eggs that the that's otherwise is thrown away. That I don't know. There's so many things out there, and there's a blue runner, which is just from Florida. That's shimaji, but nobody's catching it. They think it's trash, and you cannot even get shimaji in Japan, but you can get it's everywhere in Florida, but nobody catches it, right? So I mean, there's so many things we should be eating instead of the endangered species.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to go on for like next 2 hours. So, yeah. I'll stop.
Right. It's an interesting thing, right? It's just about knowledge of it. And, you know, otoro used to be thrown away in Japan because Japanese people didn't like fatty fish. And now it's a prize. And even in America, people didn't know that was edible. The otoro is now, I mean, 5 times more than regular sushi item. So those things is about how you get used to eating it. You have the knowledge, and then you get kind of, you know, it's just a part of your essence of eating sushi. So like hikarimono you just mentioned, this shiny fish, that's some people think it's fishy, but if it's prepared well with vinegar, as a hands down, that's my favorite sushi item. And there's one place only serves shiny fish, hikarimono, under the train station. It's a gadoshita, and that place is always packed. I have to book like a couple months in advance before I go back to Japan. So it's about how you learn, how you try it, and your makase menu is a great outlet to get to know yet to be star fish. So I'm so glad you're serving so many great sustainable fish through your makase, because I'm looking at your Instagram page. I'm getting so hungry now.
Yeah, we got the Boston mackerel, and recently we got the it's not Instagram yet, but the aji that's from Northern California. It's so good. It's so good. It's got so much flavor to it, you know. I'm sorry, and maybe I should not say that as sushi, but I'd rather eat that than otoro. I'm sorry. It's so good. You know?
Too. Yeah.
It's good.
I think hikarimono is not appreciated enough because I think it's so highly perishable, and people tend not to spend time and energy to prepare it. But once it's done, it's the bomb of umami. And yeah, I agree. Otoro tastes boring compared to good aji or hamachi or...
You are a good person. I judge people. You're a good person.
Yeah, it's just delicious. Yeah, I mean, seriously, that's the umami, essence of umami. So anyway, so we can keep talking about this, delicious hidden items, which has not been introduced, but it's a seafood. It's the whole ocean. I don't know how many thousand species swimming for us to be eaten. I think it's going to be a different landscape in 5-10 years because we are in a position to be able to choose sustainably what we're going to eat. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. But so what is your philosophy for cooking besides being fully sustainable?
What is my philosophy of cooking? Hopefully it tastes good. I don't know. People tell me that my flavor is like yasashi, it's like tender. I guess I still go with like a more of the round flavor of my grandma. How do I say it? A lot of restaurants you go to me, restaurant flavor is too sharp. And to the point that that's what the restaurant requires, right? If you go there and you want to notice this is salty, this is vinegary, this is sugary, and there's a lot of that so that you kind of feel the sensation. But my flavoring is more like kind of make you relax, just kind of like tamaking it, like, after you eat. That's what I'd like. So to me, my flavoring is more like after hard day of work or hard months that you're going to have. If I can get a little edge off, if you eat my even just the first miso soup you're going to get, you know, just a little something. Maybe also osuimono I made is just a little relaxing for you. That's my philosophy.
Like a healing in Japanese is the yashi, kind of like a nourishment for your heart and for your body as well.
Right. I think the food can be, how do you call it, like an intense flavor and kind of fancy. And, you know, it's just like, you know, put in Instagram, you know, like it's just so go. But to me, the food is who you are. Like, and sometimes it just gets too intense. And everyday life, you have the computer, you have to listen to podcasts. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, and going to the restaurant can be a little stressful. But I hope that I can give just a little glimpse of, not hope, but it just, you know, like maybe you can go on a little bit more because of my food. That's kind of like my philosophy.
Well, I think your grandmother would be very happy if she could hear what you're saying now.
I hope so.
Right. Okay. So, I heard that you pursue sustainability beyond the food you serve. For example, you try to provide sustainable work conditions for your staff. So could you tell us about it?
So same as anything, I feel like this top 1% or 1% is having so much money. And at the time that the workers are getting so minimum of what the friction of the wage, right? And to me, again, maybe I'm old school, but I don't think I'm going to retire. I don't think I'm going to have one more restaurant. You know, I want to do what I want to do. So from that point of view, literally, it's important that the, all those people I work with is having a, not having good time, but, you know, having, you know, they're having a, you know, good time too, but I want them to be with me for a long time. In Moscow, there's a lot of employees who was there for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, right? And they become more of the part of the restaurant, part of my life. So in order to do that, they have to have at least a good living wage and just have a buffer when something happens. So to me, you know, hopefully all the employer can just look at that as that, so that the make sure that the employees are taken care of and they work with you. And another side is that I'm not one of those chefs or owner that never go to the restaurant. I'm there all the time. So I have to work with those people. I want them to have a good time with me, you know?
And right.
So, yeah, I don't want to be with somebody who's, I don't know, not having a good time and spend like 10 hours with them. Like, no, that'd be horrible. I don't know. It's just, yeah.
Right. Well, I heard you offer even health insurance, which is not very common in food industry in America. So, yeah, I think the energy of the restaurants changes, and that's the real sustainability, to support sustainability on your sushi counter. So that's amazing.
Like an employee has to kind of think about not saving like $5, $10 out of the employees, but just think about like next 10 years. You know what I mean? So anyhow, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, so you are in Michigan. So what is the biggest challenge in serving sustainable Japanese seafood dishes in Michigan? Because it may be harder than in bigger coastal cities like Seattle, where you used to be, or New York or LA.
I'm not going to lie. It is harder. I'm not going to lie. Seattle is much better in terms of, like, I mean, it's a hub of the Alaskan seafood, right? I mean, that alone is going to give you like 200 different things that you can get easily. And I used to know the, diver who dived for the sea urchin. And I used to know the boat captain who catch some stuff for me. That's not going to happen, right? So, yeah, I'm still struggling to get so many things. But at the same time, I'm still learning. And, of course, for the sushi, I cannot get lake fish because of a parasites issue. But I do a lot of lake fish marinated in a sake kasu or miso or, yuanzuke or, like, a lot of things that the more traditional Japanese way of marinating fish that I can use from the lakes. So that's exciting to me. And East Coast fish that I didn't know too much about, I'm getting good to know that. And one side is, of course, it's so hard. I'll be honest with you. Oh my God, first year or so, like, I couldn't get anything. Like, I had a doubt. I don't know if I can do this. But other side of the coin, I can tell you is that the how many sustainable sushi are in the United States? Like one or two? Or maybe five, it's not increasing, right? And, they said it's so hard to do this. Now, if I can do this in Detroit, proper, Metro Detroit, then there's no excuse so whatsoever for any of the sushi bars that exist in any of the coastal town. It's so much easier to do. So why can't they do that? Come on, I can say that to you. Right. If you can do it in the Midwest, they can do it easily. What are they waiting for? Come on.
Right. It's like if you can get it to New York, you can do it anywhere. It's like you can make sushi in New Michigan out of Detroit, then you can do it anywhere in terms of sustainability. So that's amazing. But do you have specific vendors, fish suppliers to satisfy your needs, sustainable needs to... Like, you have a couple specific people, or you have to go, like, multiple vendors?
Oh, my God. So many different vendors. My wife hates me because she's doing all the paperwork. And, like, I wish that I can have, like, two or three big distributors and that's it. No, I have, like, one item from this, one item from that. The key to this, and that's why it is hard, is that the most of the restaurants has a distribution system or a distributor, salesperson, tell you what they have. And you choose from that selection. Me, I find a fish or whatever, shrimp, whatever. Then I find who can get that for me. So it's a completely different 180 of how I get the fish. So I cannot depend on the distribution. And don't get me wrong, there's so many good distributor, salesperson, all the stuff helping out, but it is really hard. So the first I do the research and make sure that it's good. Then see if anybody can find it. But that being said, there's a lot of people who's been helping me. They kind of know me by now. This weird guy is going to buy some weird stuff. So sometimes they have this, I got this weird fish. Like, do you want it? I'm like, yeah, give it to me. So so that relationship is slowly happening. And, of course, I had that more in Seattle, but slowly I feel like I will getting help. How's that?
So do you see more suppliers who can manage sustainability well?
Here's the problem, same as anything. They know sometimes what's sustainable or not, but money is there, right? So it's really hard for them to just survive on sustainable seafood distribution. So maybe they have a good intention, but slowly kind of say, well, maybe I can have this on the side. Like, well, I can have this. And it gets bigger and bigger and more sales and more money. It's really hard for them to stay sustainable. Mm. And I get it. But again, you know, if I can do it, anybody can do it, right? And I'm really frustrated with it, but you know, I cannot tell other people what to do that much. So
right. Well, I mean, by hearing what you've been saying, it's the most systematic, right? I mean, it's a sushi chef cannot try to be sustainable because if there's no supply, it's hard, and the whole system has to be changed. So how do you predict the future of sustainability? I mean, sustainable seafood. And what should we do?
Man.
It's like $1 million question. Sorry.
I told you before this interview that I don't want to tell you everything I know because I don't want to get depressed. You know, I have to give the audience hope too. But I have to scare you, right? It's bad. Ocean's in a really bad condition. And you see that, especially these days on hottest air, you know, hottest days, you know, a lot of storms. I mean, drought to too much rain to, I mean, you name it. It's a result of a lot of things, unfortunately, we did. Mm. To turn this around, it's going to be really tough. But I was kind of listening to this like a little segment on the radio saying that even if everybody wait one more year to change a cell phone, right? That alone is going to reduce so much carbon footprint. It's crazy, right? Mm. That's it. Do you really need that cell phone like this year? Wait one more year, right? It's not going to change anything. That people cannot do, right? Even like I'll tell you, not eat eel for 1 year. Can you do that? Maybe not. Or reduce 10% reduction of maybe every time you go to the sushi bar, you order toro. But maybe, I don't know, half of the time you don't and try different things, right? So there's a lot of small things people can do to make changes. I always say this. Me alone cannot really do anything. This weird guy in, you know, Metro Detroit that does a sustainable sushi cannot change the world. But can you imagine entire world says, hey, let's do 10% reduction or whatever that they can change. That can change the entire dynamic of the entire ecosystem. 10% reduction is something, right? Something that is decided as a country, as a individual, but people don't. That's what kind of frustrates me, right?
Interesting. So, like, you know, the COVID was a good example, right? Because we stopped going out entirely, stopped driving cars in many cases. Then the whole ecology changed for the better, like looking back at least several years. So that proven if you change your behavior, something guaranteed it's going to happen. But so, for example, we talked about the hikarimono, like makgeo to kohara, something perishable, but the umami bomb. I think if 10% of the customers switch from toro to hikarimono, I think that's great. And also, you know, it's a full of omega-3 fatty acids. Maybe your brain is going to be better too. So little thing. So listeners, if you next time go to a sushi place, stop thinking of salmon, bluefin tuna, then try some shiny fish because it's good for you and it's delicious. So.
Yeah, and less mercury too, right? Mm, it's good for you, right? So, you know, if you're looking, like maybe you don't care about sustainability at all, you know, you're an asshole. Okay, fine. But if you are totally care about your health only, you should be still eating smaller fish, right?
Totally.
Yeah, anyhow.
Right. So, and also, I stress, hikarimono is the most delicious. That's my go-to. I mean, when I go back to Japan and go to any sushi restaurant, it's so hard to hear and to find the good hikarimono because of the supply. And Japan is such a, you know, the treasure box for hikarimono. So, Yeah, I can be commissioned by Hikarimono company. But,
you can be a Hikarimono ambassador for the whole world.
Yeah, I'll be very proud.
Yes, excellent.
So, anyway, so what are your plans and dreams?
What are plans and dreams? Oh, man. I don't know. I hope that I can keep going what I'm doing, you know, with all the stuff that I have. This work is something that is never ending, right? I can improve just a little bit tomorrow. And tomorrow, I can improve touch more and the day after tomorrow. That's the name of the game here. So, you know, I hope that I can improve touch more in 20 years. And if I can make, you know, 100 people more happy, you know, and that's my goal. And, you know, sustainability wise, I don't know. Here's the thing, you know, people, you know, I do appreciate it, James Beard and all the stuff too, but to me, it's a tool to reach out to more people, right? So, you know, even this interview, I really do appreciate you doing this because that the more people can just do a change just a little bit every single day. If I can convince like 10 more people a month even, that, you know, I don't think I'm that smart. I don't think I can do that much, but maybe there's the people who's smarter than me. Maybe they have, I don't know, some kind of like math degree, engineer degree that you can change some things that maybe a new fishing gear or different kind of ports that's more sustainable, different car that's a little better. And those are the people, and maybe I can just kind of, you know, give them a little bit of message so that they can do something about it.
Right. And you are often asked to speak at schools for younger generations about sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, so I do tell them, like, look, I'm going to be gone, you know. I'm going to die, you know, hopefully not pretty soon, but, you know, I cannot live that long. So it's their generation, right? And I actually apologize to them. Like, I'm so sorry my generation kind of screwed up for you. Mm-hmm. And now you have to deal with it. But it is true that they have to deal with it, right? So, you know, I guess, you know, there's a lot of politics and all the stuff too. And then sometimes, oh man, I don't want to bitch so much about so many people, but like those billionaires, like trying to go to Mars, like, you know, there's a planet we can fix first before you go to Mars, and people are still living here already, you know, and maybe we can work on that maybe, you know, I feel like we can do just a touch better job every day.
Right. Yeah, and there's a lot of food for thoughts. So thank you so much. And where can we find your updates online and on social media and keep thinking about sustainability?
First of all, before me, like a sustainable seafood watch is great. Noah has a really good the website that you can look at too. You know, just kind of ask around about, you know, different things. And you can ask chef, fishmongers, just give them some questions so that they feel a little bit pressure by the consumer like you guys. That's what I had to say, number one. Number two, if you wanted to see what I got, the social media, I think we have Instagram and Facebook, I think. Sorry, I'm so not tech savvy. I think it's Sozai, and another one is Bancho Hajime. That's my thing. And I try to post not just the fancy food, but try to talk about the sustainability also. So, yeah. And if you come to, you know, Metro Detroit, stop by.
Right. So I think the one you mentioned, Noah, is noahclimate.com. And of course, the Montreal Aquarium Seafood Watch, that's everywhere. So the your restaurant's website, Sozai Restaurant, S-O-Z-A-I-R, S-O-Z-A-I restaurant.com, and also Instagram, and the Bancho Hajime, that's also Instagram. So This is amazing. And I thank you for your tons of inspiration. And I really think about what you do whenever next time I go to a sushi restaurant and also when I purchase seafood. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Liam Werner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.